Welcome to the Reasoned Roundtable, your weekly libertarian podcast from the magazine that's been saying nobody should have to go to jail for smoking weed for about 54 years longer than Kamala Harris has. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Happy Indigenous Peoples and Italian Heritage Day, amigos.
Howdy.
Yeah.
Happy Monday.
Hey, Matt.
We are going to get to the president's historic pardon of 6,500 drug felons here in a moment. But first, 20 years ago, a guy named Jack, frustrated with his ADHD and the inadequacy of Adderall in helping overcome energy crashes, mood swings, brain fog, and stomach pain, developed a product called Functional Coffee. It's been enjoyed by millions. Now Jack's back with a mushroom-based coffee called Everyday Dose. Everyday Dose is the healthiest and most convenient alternative to traditional coffee out there, giving you energy and focus without making you irritable or ripping up your guts. And it still gives you caffeine, still tastes like coffee. You ever wonder why Nick Gillespie is so pleasant and alert in the morning? Well, he is one of the product's many happy customers. You too can try Everyday Dose's delicious, better for you without the jitters, crash, or digestive issues. Coffee, I think is the word I was supposed to include in there. By going to www.everydaydose.com, it's absolutely risk-free, 60-day money-back guarantee. Go to everydaydose.com and start thinking different about the morning. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. Okay. For almost a decade now, anytime a Democrat, you can't talk, Nick. Nope. Anytime a Democrat has been in political trouble in the run-up to an election, there has been a contingent of commentators who say things like, dude, why don't you just legalize weed? After all, that's way more popular than you. Last Thursday, President Joseph Robin F. Biden Jr. took that advice at least very partially to heart, announcing presidential pardons for every U.S. citizen and lawful resident who had been convicted in federal court of simple marijuana possessions, and beseeching state governors who have jurisdiction over far more drug felons to follow suit. Biden also called for an administrative review of how the drug is currently classified under federal law. The president's narrow pardon affects, as mentioned before, around 6,500 people, virtually all of whom were not currently behind bars. It also does not apply to people who were not lawful permanent residents of these United States at the time of their arrest. Reason magazine, as you'd expect, has already published a bunch of analysis verbiage, of which includes Biden's marijuana reforms are long overdue, but will have just a modest impact by Jacob Sullum. Biden is still seeking potential life sentences for distributing weed, even as he pardons for possession by Billy Binion. And Biden's bombshell weed announcement is both bigger and smaller than it might seem by Elizabeth Nolan Brown. Catherine, you are the Goldilocks of federal drug policy. Is the porridge too cold, too hot, or just right?
I guess by the logic of your metaphor, it's just right. But now I'm confused because it was a bad metaphor. Okay. Yeah. So this is, as you can gather from our two-handed headlines, you know, it's good. I actually am more cheerful about this than the average Reason staffer, I would say. I think that it is a genuine step forward for a sitting president to say, hey, this seems dumb and we should stop doing it. Now, does he actually have the power to take a dent out of the biggest problems with marijuana prohibition? No, he doesn't. And, you know, do I love that this time Joe Biden was like, sorry, friends, there are limits on my powers and there's only so much I can do. Whereas with apparently everything else, he's like, yeah, I'm in charge of, you know, all of student loans and also the rental market in the United States. But still, I appreciate that in this case, he has correctly described for the American people which moving parts need to move in order to actually end the threat of people going to prison for smoking weed. I, of course, would like to see more. Who doesn't want to see more? Legalize heroin, etc. Cocaine and vending machines is the American way. But I will take this. And I hope that later on we don't get the dumbest possible variant of this discourse, which Tom Cotton has already previewed, which is the crime rates are up and Joe Biden is here letting the weed felons go free. I think there is a chance that that is what Republicans choose to go with. I wish they wouldn't.
Nick, I remember about 20 years ago, maybe, I saw you at Los Angeles.
Before I was drinking everyday dose, Matt, and I've got endorphins to spare now.
I saw you at an LA Press Club book event for Jacob Sullum's Saying Yes, at which you mentioned in a very passionate way that has stuck with me ever since, that the long drug war in America, which really is a war on marijuana, or has been as its main engine, made you ashamed to be an American. That's a direct quote back in the day. I mean, you were high as fuck, but I'm just wondering if you want to get in touch with your feelings. How does your American ashamedness feel in the wake of this limited but significant announcement?
No, I'm more with Catherine than I don't know who the naysayers on the Reason staff are exactly, but you know, this doesn't go far enough, but it's a step in the right direction. And you know, we've all seen Joe Biden walk. I mean, any step in the right direction is kind of a major triumph.
That was such a cheap shot, and we both just fully fell for it.
Yeah.
He's like, who was the Tim Conway character on the old Carol Burnett show, Mr. Fuff and Stuffer or something? Yeah. You know, the super old guy who could barely move, or Artie Johnson on Laugh-In, Matt. You remember Laugh-In.
Laughing is even. I only saw that in reruns, Nick.
Same with me. I don't think I was allowed to stay up until 8 o'clock or whatever it was on in first order. But no, I think this is good. It's a step in the right direction. And this, you know, both shows the way that the drug war is going to end and the limitations on that. You know, it's the drug war is going to end because there is a bipartisan consensus minus Tom Cotton, who I'm sure, you know, on one of the human events or something has a column that's called Cotton Picking Minute with Tom Cotton. But everybody except for Tom Cotton is going to be like, yeah, you know what, this is really insane and it's been insane the whole time and we're going to get rid of it eventually, slowly at first and then all at once, and then we'll never speak of it again. But I think it's good.
I want to talk a little bit about that, both the cotton picking moment and the kind of structural way this happens. Peter, you live in Washington. Cotton has called this a desperate attempt to distract from failed leadership and claimed falsely in our own CJ Sharmala, who was fantastic on this podcast last week, has mentioned down that Cotton's contention that that most of these people pled down for more serious charges is hogwash. It's bandersnatch. I'm sure, Peter, in the face of rising crime, we're going to see a lot of this kind of politicking, the people who are worried about all the crazies on the streets of big cities. And I'm kind of one of them. Might use this to try to make people to create a politics of being anti lifting this stuff. Is there something structural I want you to reflect on, Mr. Suderman, about how slow it takes Washington to get to this place, right? Like Biden, who's had a long history of being a pro-drug war guy, takes him all the way to 2022 when we've had on the state level reform for nearly three decades. Is there something about national politics or the structure of the way that Washington works that makes the federal government act so tardily in this direction?
I think that's probably correct, just given that the way that Congress is set up. I mean, liberals complain about this all the time. When I say this, it's going to be descriptive rather than necessarily sort of a complaint. But the way that Congress is set up is that it does give some disproportionate power to rural voters, and in particular to older rural voters, and because of the makeup of the Senate, and just because of who votes and who are the least pro drug freedom voters in the United States, older rural conservative voters. And so they have somewhat disproportionate power in terms of their vote and, because of the Senate. And then that affects national politics and party politics in ways that I think we have seen play out over the past couple of years. The other thing that's going to happen here structurally is that whenever the president of either party stakes out a strong position on a potentially controversial issue, it is nearly always the case that the other party, even if they had been moderating or softening on that issue themselves, will then decide, oh no, this is now the time to go back and make it and make that an attack. And so the Republican Party may have been on a overall good trajectory, or sort of better, you know, in the direction of like let's prosecute fewer people for drug crimes. But this move has the potential to rally Republicans back to a more prohibitionist stance, in particular since crime, which is really a sort of referendum on urban disorder, is going to be one of the three or four biggest issues in the midterm and probably in the presidential election coming up in 2024. And I mean, we're already seeing this with Tom Cotton. Republicans are going to try to say that our cities are crime ridden. And then the evidence they will use is, see, look at all the people on the streets. And then they will say those people are crazy drug users. And then Biden is making that worse by moving in a direction of legalization. The other thing we should say, though, this isn't legalization. And Biden's request to look at descheduling or rescheduling marijuana is, if it goes well, we're going to get an answer on that in a couple of years.
Catherine, at the outset here, I quoted Kamala Harris's statement over the weekend, which Elizabeth Nolan Brown wrote about just this morning. She said nobody should have to go to jail for smoking weed. I know that you have said that your porridge was at least half warm.
Half warm.
How did you?
That's that. That's the microwave setting that you used, right?
Matt, I think that's right. Bandersnatch.
Well, that's our huff and fluffle. Catherine, how did your robot libertarian heart take Kamala Harris saying this, given her cover girl performance?
My heart is all too human in this case, and it is full of hate. Like, I need to.
It's grown three sizes.
It's grown
big.
Three sizes smaller. Like, it's, you know, I know that the correct stance is in fact the headline that Liz Nolan Brown put on this piece, which is better late than never. This is right. It is better that she now is less horrible on this issue. But I am struggling with forgiveness, Matt. And the fact that she absolutely does not seem to know what she's talking about is part of the problem, right? It would be one thing if she sort of had the ability to deliver an analysis of why she had changed her mind. If she had some kind of just like four or five sentences that made me believe that she understood what, you know, it's like when your kids are in trouble and you're like, you are in big trouble. And they're like, I'm sorry. And you're like, do you know what you're in trouble for? And they're like, no. Like, it was like, it's like that. Like, she knows she's in timeout, but she doesn't know why. And it's going to happen again.
It is very telling that if you want to, like, this might be Kamala Harris's best moment from a libertarian perspective. And her best moment as vice president is a total repudiation of her pre-Senate, pre-vice presidency political career.
Yeah. And I do, again, this is not her first like turn on this, right? Like, she actually has been changing her views on this issue. And you know, I must in the end overcome my baser instincts and say, welcome to the right side of history. But man, I'm just still mad about it.
Nick, given your interviews, especially over the years with Ken Burns, and another thing that stuck out with me forever is when he was talking about his documentary about prohibition, and this is like almost 10 years ago, and you asked him about like, alcohol prohibition. I wonder if there are any lessons applicable to modern society and policy. And he's like, yeah, totally. The Tea Party sucks.
And like, well, I mean, was he wrong, though, in the end about that specifically?
It's like the hierarchy of needs here.
The hierarchy
Maslow,
of weed. Maslow.
What? You really Maslow woke up on the dad joke bake. Side of the bed this morning, Nick.
But Nick, do you think, like, looking around, including at stuff like this same administration's policies about vaping, have we learned the lessons of prohibition in any meaningful sense, or did just you know, this policy happened to align well for the moment with Democrats.
Yeah. Now, we have not learned the lessons of prohibition, and, you know, we refuse to. It's, you know, if you think, you know, second graders lost a lot in the COVID lockdowns, like, you know, the American government has, they've been in timeout for, you know, like 60 or 70 years. They have forgotten everything that they ever learned about prohibition. And I don't think that's coming back anytime soon. But again, you know, this is, you know, kind of picking up on what Peter was talking about. It's not about what DC does on this kind of stuff. I think what is going to happen is there will be advances throughout the country at every level. It's already happening. And, you know, DC will be the last domino to fall in all of this. And they will acknowledge where the rest of the country is and has been for decades. And what's disturbing about that, and, you know, and this is where I join my colleagues in being pissed about this, because every day that, you know, weed remains illegal and people who are in jail for nonviolent offenses that are related to, you know, weed, you know, there are people just rotting in jail, and, you know, we all lose with that. So you want it to hurry up as fast as possible. But it's, you know, I don't think it's going to be let out of D.C. and certainly not out of the White House. You know, the only guy who would have done that was Gary Johnson. And he sadly came in a distant third in a contested election, by the way, an election that seems to have been stolen from somebody. I don't know who. Maybe it was
me.
Gary.
They're always stolen from me. Speaking of incarceration and whatnot. It's one of the underexplored backdrops to economic numbers that come out in terms of employment. If you're currently or formerly incarcerated, it's, you're barred by a lot of people from getting jobs. And this is a segue into two emails I received this morning, back to back, 6:35 a.m. and 6:36 a.m. Eastern. First from the Dispatch, second from the New York Times. I don't think I signed up for either, by the way. They just come to me. The subject lines were economy still too hot and the cooling economy. the Times at least had
not necessarily contradictory. You can have a cup of coffee that is cooling down, but still too hot,
or a bowl of porridge.
Suderman's jumping the line here. So the Times said that keeping track of the U.S. economy can sometimes feel a bit like watching an action movie through a magnifying glass. I get that.
Oh, bravo.
Lots of movement and flashing lights, but it's hard to figure out what's going on. The proximate cause of all this confusion is the news that came out Friday, which, and this will again quote the Times, the unemployment rate fell, but the labor force shrank. Job gains slowed, but wage growth remained high. The report from the BLS mostly met analyst expectations, yet the stock market tumbled. Peter, I think it was you who coined the phrase "the weird economy." Is that what happened on this podcast? Something
like
that.
How the economy is weird.
Can you give it?
That's true. I don't know if I coined the phrase.
What type of ocular device should we look at this through? A magnifying glass, a monocle, a telescope,
space telescope.
Let's look at this economy in 8K at 120
hertz.
There's now 8K televisions on the market.
Is that like those razors with all the blades? In them?
Basically, no content for them, but they're great. It's wonderful. Right. So, like, I kind of feel like this economy is like. It's like the Monday morning after you had way too good a time on Friday night.
It's like the Mandalorian.
I'm going to let
just
Nick go with the metaphor here.
It's exactly like the Mandalorian. We get it.
No, it's like the Mandalorian, but I'm curious to find out how, since I don't know.
I was just rummaging through my garbage, and I came up with the Mandalorian.
Go, Peter. Ignore him. Go on.
So the short version is that after a huge unprecedented jump, a huge unprecedented job losses in 2020 during the pandemic, hiring went crazy. Headline employment is at the lowest rate since the 1960s. Workers are able to switch jobs and demand higher wages, or have been for the last year or so. But that hiring spree is slowing. That doesn't mean that it is gone. It just means that the intensity of it is reducing. And labor force participation at the same time is way down. So remember that headline employment measures the percentage of people who are actively looking for work. So you can have a lot of, right.
Unemployment. Headline.
Sorry.
Unemployment.
Headline unemployment. Right. Measures the percentage of people who are actively looking for work. And so a lot of people have just stopped looking for work completely. And then meanwhile, inflation just keeps keeping on. Because, in part, because workers have had increased leverage. And what does that mean? That means higher wages. So that's good for workers in some ways, but it also means higher prices for consumers. And in general, prices have risen faster than wages. So even though people are earning more, that doesn't necessarily mean that they have more buying power. And I continue to think that this will be one of the biggest issues, maybe the single biggest issue when it comes to the midterm election, that despite gas prices coming down somewhat, voters and especially older rural voters, the same ones who have made who have slowed, you know, pot legalization just because of sort of their disproportionate impact on D.C. politics. I think they are going to be very, very focused on price increases, on inflation, and on food prices in particular. Just a little telling anecdote, CNN began an opinion series last week on big issues affecting the country, and the headline for the first installment was, "I retired during the pandemic, now inflation has me counting pennies." We are going to hear a lot of that over the next 4 weeks or so in the run-up to the midterm.
Nick, back a decade ago, there's this book that came out called The Declaration of Independence.
How Libertarian Politics. Matt Welch. What's the subtitle?
I forget. But in it, one of the consistent themes that we've been hammering and had been hammering in recent for a long time is that we're out of money. And I feel like now that's what a twee and naive concept, considering that the rest of the political class has been acting like what was it, Willem Dafoe, in To Live and Die in L.A., where he's just like burning Bravo. Money. And
no, that's the Joker in the second Batman movie.
Yeah. No, it's To all, Live and Die
all
in
the
L.A.
above. Like, do everything. All filmed in Long Beach, California, by the way, all of it. So let's shout out to the LBC. Anyways, given all that has happened since, like on a bipartisan level, including Josh Hammer. We don't really know, but he's got a great name, and he says crazy things at national conservative conferences. And
I like
one of the
his
things he said,
"Column can't touch this." With Josh Hammer,
just furious,
big shoulder pads. He recently in his speech that was trumped up by the national conservative people talked about now after all of this Willem Dafoe counterfeit burning. It's time to reject the, quote, ghoulish libertarian zombie Hayekianism in favor of a positive vision of government, using it for the good of the family and the nation. How does that make you feel about the state of American politics now?
I think Peter wants to say something about zombie Hayekianism, though. Because wasn't Salma Hayek, was she technically a zombie or was she merely a vampire, a vampira?
And, I think looking at Josh Hammer's output, it's pretty clear that he, you know, the zombies have gone after him and like found his brains.
Yeah, they started with the brains, right? Yeah, we're not out of money, right? We're out of money that can buy stuff, but we can keep printing, Matt. There's like there's no limit on that. But I find over the past couple of weeks, I went back and reread Robert Samuelson, the former, I believe he's retired now, longtime Washington Post and Newsweek columnist before its, you know, new turn to the right. His book, The Great Inflation and Its Aftermath, which was about the last time that macroeconomics and policymakers couldn't really make sense of what was going on. And this was in the late 60s and the 70s, where by, you know, the reigning theories of the day, there shouldn't have been high unemployment and high inflation at the same time, but there was. And he talked about how, you know, the explanatory theory or belief in the explanatory theories had just run out. And, you know, and reality was encroaching. And I feel like we're very much in that kind of circumstance right now because there is so much oddness going on. And, you know, the inflation that finally kicked into gear over the past year or two had been predicted for a long time by, you know, probably all of us on this podcast at some point. But it's around, you know, this, what we'll, I suspect we'll talk more about kind of labor force participation rights and how that is, you know, kind of going in bizarre directions, particularly considering unemployment. But we don't have good tools to explain it, or rather, the people not on this podcast and who don't work at Reason don't have good tools to explain what's going on, because they don't want to admit that they're going to have to start reining in government spending if they want the economy to kind of get back into gear in a way that is sustainable for long-term economic growth. And I think that's what it comes down to.
At the same time, it's worth remembering that in that era, in the late 1960s, there was just this overriding confidence amongst economic policymakers and analysts, to the point where the White House budget director, Charles Schulz, there's this great story, a great quote from, it's, I believe it's the cover story, we're the widely known cover story, We're All Keynesians Now, where Charles Schulz just says, "We can't prevent every little wiggle in the economic cycle, but we now can prevent a major slide." And this was the late 1960s, and that was just their assumption, was that they had macro licked. It was all right, just like a bowl of porridge. They were just going to, nope, I don't know where I'm going with that. But like, yeah. it was
they weren't
over.
There were
never going to be any more unwanted fluctuations. And then the 1970s happened and just completely wrecked all of those theories. And you had high on inflation and huge amounts of spending, and the Fed kept pumping money into the system. There were political choices made to allow inflation to continue, because the assumption was that if we don't, we will have high unemployment, and we'd rather have high inflation than high unemployment. And we have to protect, Nixon in particular made choices to push the Fed to keep the economy from becoming like a high unemployment economy, because he felt like Republicans would do badly at the polls if that's what they had. And that all culminated in the 1980 election, in which, if you go back to the 1980 election, there was a bunch of stuff going on in the world, but the election was just about inflation. It really was like, if you could have eliminated all the other things, the thing that mattered, if you look at the polls, if you look at what everything they talked about during the debates, it was entirely about inflation, because that's what people were mad about, because it affected them every single day.
Yeah, there's also the hostage crisis. I'm old enough to remember that one. Catherine, I would invite you to channel your inner dark Suderman in telling the assembled class about why the following news nugget matters. Last week, we crossed through $31 trillion of national debt. Why does it matter?
The reason it matters is because it's money we don't have. We just still don't have that money. We have no way to pay it back. We have no theory of how to pay it back, except the newly-ish popular theory that we can inflate our way out of having to worry about that number, which is like the worst possible outcome here. Like, what if money doesn't really buy things anymore or mean anything anymore? Then all this money we borrowed won't be a problem. And this is like real last ditch logic against some numbers that are now just spectacularly awful. I do think that just in general, the kind of illiteracy about these macro trends among our politicians is like, it's probably not getting worse, because politicians have always been garbage and they'll always disappoint us. But, you know, California started the checks, the inflation checks came out today. Or maybe Friday. Californians are receiving in their bank accounts checks from the government. They just printed money, essentially, or they borrowed money to send out checks to people to help them cover the increased costs of everyday stuff that have increased due to inflation. This is exactly wrong, California. You have done it wrong. And, it just seems like at every level, our thinking about government spending and our thinking about the ways that government spending interacts with broader economic factors is, it seems to be self-consciously enumerate at this point. It seems to be that we are just going to not think about it and hope that it all works out in the end. And that is not a good strategy.
Inflation is too much money chasing too few goods.
And so putting a lot more money into the system isn't going to fix any of the problems.
And California's response is, but what if we gave people
more money? More
okay.
money. We'll do it. Well, also,
too much money already.
We're also simultaneously doing several things to decrease the supply of goods. Like, that's the other thing we should keep in mind here. Like, every time we throw up a new trade barrier, every time we throw up a new immigration barrier, we are pushing on the other side of that equation as well. And I think that that is
Catherine, I'm sorry, I've got to interject here.
Yeah.
Two words. Made in America.
I mean, I know it's a cliche to say that we are living in idiocracy, but we really, really are. We super are.
You know, the other major thing, to go back when Peter was talking about it, you know, at least the best and the brightest believed in the bullshit they were spewing, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s. The Republican Party has completely cratered, even with a, you know, with the rhetoric of fiscal responsibility. They never had it, you know, and I mean, this is the story of the 21st century, is that Bush was the biggest spender on both foreign stuff or, you know, defense, but also on domestic policy since LBJ. And if we're going to have a constitutional convention, we probably should make it so that nobody from Texas is ever allowed to be president again. That might be a good starting point. But the Republicans don't even talk about fiscal responsibility anymore. There is no interest in discussing reining in government spending. And that is a real difference. And it's one that makes these conversations even more difficult to have. But the, you know, the fact of the matter is there's broad consensus among economists that, you know, massive growing national debt that that nobody shows any interest in tempering has a really negative effect, all things being equal, on long-term economic growth, which is exactly what we've been seeing in the 21st century and are likely to see, you know, for the foreseeable future.
All right. We're going to get to our listener email of the week here in a moment. And then afterwards, we're going to talk a little bit more about economic related things. But first, look, we're all responsible adults here. We do what it takes to ensure our families in case of medical emergency. But what many of us don't realize is that health insurance won't always cover the full cost of an emergency medical flight. Even comprehensive coverage can leave you with high deductibles and copays. That's where AirMedCare Network comes in. When you sign up, become a member. Should any such emergency arise, you still will not see a bill for air medical transport when flown by an AMCN provider. AirMedCare flying machines transport more than 100,000 patients each year. Best of all, this peace of mind for your whole family can be yours, beginning at the low, low price of $85 a year. Listeners to the Roundtable can get gift cards with their new memberships for up to $50 through either Visa or Amazon gift cards. Simply visit airmedcarenetwork.com/reason and use the offer code REASON and start protecting your family. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right, reminder, email your brief queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from Zach with an H. I think Zach's with a, yeah, well, I don't want to insult the poor Zach's parents, but I like the K in a Zach. Anyways, what's the take on the classic car warranty renewal? There's a lot of everyday notes just coursing through my veins right now. What's the take on the classic car warranty renewal junk mail or life insurance upsells, often employing phrases like final notice, addressed mail that attempts to fool the recipient into taking out a new service by using personal information like your full legal name, vehicle details to imply an existing commercial relationship? Bonus, these senders depend on using government data like DMV records and are typically delivered by the U.S. Postal Service, Catherine. Free market, free speech, consumer beware, or state-enabled spear phishing that defrauds the elderly? Asking the big questions here, says Zach. Catherine, what say you? Is there a libertarian take on the fact that we're all getting scammed all the time?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I want to stick up for Zach with an H, which is clearly the correct spelling, and you're wrong. Second, it's a little bit of both, actually. I do think, you know, there is I've certainly read a few treatments that are like deep dives into what the hell is going on with the spam calls, because it does. I understand why people feel like it's a market failure, right? It feels like this is just allowed and everyone hates it. And why is it not allowed? And maybe we need government regulation to solve it. But there is definitely another layer of argumentation that basically says what Zach alludes to here, which is that we've created sort of pricing systems that are dependent on government regulation, and also that there are data sets available that maybe we could restrict access to that wouldn't require actual regulation and bans on these kind of calls, and instead have just accidentally incentivized them or made them sort of cheaper than the market would otherwise suggest. You know, this is the sort of most classic libertarian answer to this is like, well, is it fraud, right? And I think in some cases it does cross that line. And the remedy for fraud is typically, you know, we seek it in the courts. So, you know, there certainly have been like class action lawsuits to try and stop spam calling that have not been successful. But yeah, I think this is one of those like, even in Libertopia, not everything is going to be great and convenient and exactly to your liking. And I am not sure that I can in the end tell Zach like, yes, if I were the libertarian queen of the universe, no one would ever spam call you again. Sometimes commercial come-ons are annoying. I do feel like there should be better third-party products to block those types of calls or to, you know, otherwise avoid solicitations and mailings. And I suspect that there may be some regulatory barriers to the existence of those that I would like to see swept away.
So I should just point out that since 2003, we have had a national do not call registry operated by the FCC in compliance with a law passed by Congress. Has that done you any good? Do you feel like the FCC is making this better for you? The thing that is making it better is the fact that I have an iPhone where I can block callers and I can block these calls. Now, that service doesn't work perfectly. Sometimes there are new numbers. Sometimes there are things that I have not yet blocked. But in fact, my iPhone settings make it pretty difficult to get in contact with me, to the point where I occasionally don't get calls from people that I want. And you can set up your iPhone to just kind of not allow people to bother you. And you can also ignore it. You can put the mute on and turn off the notifications and then not worry about it. And that's maybe not the ideal solution for everyone.
Does anybody get the impression that Peter is setting up an elaborate alibi?
Yeah, I didn't get those calls.
I
have no idea what you're talking about.
I get those calls.
By Peter, the way, it's also able to do that on an Android. And one of the big things, I'm on Verizon. I hate to give away that kind of privacy on a podcast that is listened to by dozens, but Verizon has started a spam alert. So like, you know, 9 out of 10 calls I get, basically anybody who's calling you, unless it's an emergency, is a scammer. But it's all getting flagged. This strikes me as, if this is what you're worrying about, you know, as we, you know, as the planet engulfs in flames and debt and, you know, transgender madness, and Matt is getting top surgery next week, and you're worried about, you know, come-ons to old people, you got a pretty good life. Enjoy it.
But come-ons to old people, Peter, and I'll just wave away Nick for the moment. It's a kind of a problem for old people. You're from Florida, Peter, so you know old people. You might even be related to some. They get those phone calls. They're even dumber on an iPhone than I am. And before you know it, someone's life savings is down the toilet. I mean, it kind of sucks, doesn't it?
It certainly sucks if someone loses their life savings. Do we think that a lot of old people are losing their life savings very specifically to these sorts of calls and mailers? I think a lot of people are very annoyed by them, somewhat confused and frustrated when they think maybe I have a pre-existing business relationship and I have to read through a bunch of fine print, when in fact you can do like I do and throw out all mail that isn't magazines or a check without looking at it.
It's great for an able-minded 40-something.
I'm now beginning to feel grateful that I can reach Peter at all. Like, I've been trying to reach you about your car's extended warranty,
there
Peter.
There are still too many people who can reach me. And I just, like, this is the whole
thing. Yes, we're getting that feeling. Like a, you know, the feeling
really
is mutual, Peter. Yeah.
You're walking a mile in your own shoes.
Your heartfelt concern, I think, is coming from a place of personal experience. What is the, all of us who have cared for older, dumber parents are in this circumstance where you are like, oh my God, what did my father, mother, or whoever do that is really idiotic? What is a way around this? Because these kinds of scams are time immemorial. They obviously morph and mutate onto any new media. But what do you do?
There's a, I think it was retweeting a Virginia Postrel tweet or a tweet that was based on a column.
It was actually an interesting article about how, you know, reverse mortgages actually make a lot of sense.
Yeah. So, I was pointing out something that's true. I have gone through this, and I know tons of people go through it, 'cause I'm in my mid-50s, where, like, you at some point take more responsibility for looking through your parents, especially kind of bill paying as they become more Joe Biden-y in their approach to the world and the English language. And one of the things that when we started to do this, my dad at, like, I don't know, 5 years ago, a little bit less, but a stupid, consistent little example. There are so many people out there who are still paying for a fax line. And this is not even like the person calling you saying they're going to send you to Social Security prison if you don't make a car payment, which is, I've never understood like how that works. But like, it's actually, there's like this sort of ghost economy out there that just kind of chugs along. And a lot of it's big corporations based in Florida, Peter. I would single one out in particular, but I won't because I have to check myself. I want them to die in a fire. But
AOL survived for like 10 or 15 years past the point where anyone was using it, more or less, just because people had forgotten to cancel their subscriptions.
And like a lot of Delaware's state economy is based on kind of like these insurance things that don't roll over. It's kind of crazy. And some of this, you're going to find actual fraudsters who like to prey on the loneliness and confusion of the olds so that they make decisions over the telephone that they should not make. But there's also like, multi-billion dollar companies that are otherwise respectable that are trying to confuse people with timeshares and reverse mortgages. It's just awful. So anyways, I retweeted that and pointed this out because it is, you're right, Nick, it bothers me. But the morality of people who are making money doing this, I think they're really despicable human beings and they make me mad. And when I mentioned this, people came back with me, and I'm going to get it wrong, but Nick will correct me, but there's a service called like Rocket Bills or Rocket Media or something like that, that basically specializes in this. They will figure out, especially the olds, but they'll do it for even confused youngs like me, to go through your bills and say, oh yeah, you're paying for, you know, any number of hundreds of dollars worth of crap that you don't even.
That is also its own self a form of scam, because they,
I'm sure,
they bill you for all of the reduction in subscriptions that will take years to actually come due on you. But
yeah, and then you're a monthly subscriber to that service too. Yeah, you know, so I'm not endorsing it, just people gave me the information.
I came from people who were still renting a phone from the phone company well into the 90s. You know, almost until the day they died. So like, I am very personally aware of dealing with people who are suckers and rubes and just bad at finances. I'm not questioning that, Matt, and it is an issue. I don't know what you do about it in a way where you don't choke off everything that is innovative and different, other than making people more financially, kind of literate and, you know, creating more, either whether it's nonprofits or just family consciousness about this kind of stuff.
Yeah. There's always in fraud, especially, and this is every kind of fraud that has nothing to do with this, including like, what do they do to hospitals? They sort of like hack the ransomware stuff. You find the level at which that the amount of money is low enough that it's not going to be worth your hassle to go through the court system. And that's how much you can soak people for. And that's just that's a constant problem, and I don't think there is a solution to it. All right, enough of that crap. I wanted to get, before we go, and Nick, I know that you and I both have been marinating in this, and this has to do kind of in with our previous topic about the economy, there's kind of a little mini flurry of new books, most prominently Richard Reed's, and Nick, I know you've been grappling with that book, and you have the title in front of your name, in front of your head, in which I don't right now, but there's a lot of like, there we go, Of Boys and Men by Richard Reeves.
An erotic memoir.
I thought it was an early 1990s R&B group.
People have been have been ruminating
in the
trouble with men and masculinity. Just keep going, Peter.
We're having a Boys to Men moment.
People have been talking
Boys to Men, Matt Welch.
Nick, why is the masculinity crisis your fault?
Well, you know, Matt, I think it's yours and mine because we are, you're over the age of 55, right? Or you're 55?
Not quite.
Are you 55?
Just physically. I'm 54.
Okay.
I'm not quite, I'm not the age of Hagar yet.
You're about to join the one segment of the economy that is still working in large and growing numbers, which are people, men and women over 55 or 55 and older. And I think that's part of it is that the economy, something weird is going on. This, which is that if you go back to 2020, every age group below 55 is working at a lower rate than they were in 2020. And so, you know, part of the masculinity crisis, and I think that's too strong a word for it, but some of the problems is that, you know, men don't seem to have the work and the jobs that once made them feel good about themselves. Part of it might be that boomers and older Gen X people are sticking around much longer. And I don't know, but there's a real imbalance. There's a real generational imbalance in the workforce that is large and growing and is also compounded by the Center for American Progress came out with a report last fall where it turned out that more Gen Z and millennials said that they were incapable because of physical problems to go about their daily activities than boomers and Gen X people. So there's something weird going on that fuels part of the oddness in the economy, where younger people are working less and they feel less well physically and mentally on a daily basis.
Peter, I would like to ask you about the disability component of that. The disability part of Social Security is the one that's supposed to go bankrupt first. Something like there's been, I interviewed Nicholas Ebersad of the American Enterprise Institute. He's got an update, a refresh of a 2016 book called Men Without Work, I think it was. And he's got a post-pandemic kind of update to it. And he paints a very weird to me picture, which I didn't really understand until recently, of just kind of a constant through line of defection from the labor force. He's focusing particularly on men, but it's also happens elsewhere, but that it's almost impervious to business cycles. People just keep defecting more and more to the point where now that's four times or four and a half times the number of officially unemployed people are just not working. And he doesn't really get too much in the causes and effects, just sort of says we don't know. But certainly that their lifestyles are being financed by disability insurance. Can you reflect on disability kind of policy and what that might be doing and maybe even in the wake of the pandemic?
Disability has become a form of de facto sort of workaround welfare in the United States. And there are people who think that this is at least part of the reason why people are dropping out of the workforce. At the same time, if you look at Europe and Canada, it's not as if Europe and Canada have small welfare states. They've heard of welfare. And the workforce issues that we are having don't exist there. So there is, I think, it's something that's beyond policy and that's beyond just financial incentives going on. And I mean, you know, to bring it back to early 1990s music, George Thorogood and the Destroyers had it right. You got to get a haircut and get a real job, and people aren't.
Wow.
Wow. That was incredible. A+. No don'ts.
Catherine, can you make any musical comparison to help
us
through?
No, I can't. You've met me. I absolutely cannot.
I just was trying to see if you could stretch a little bit, but no.
This is going to end with Matt quoting Loverboy somehow.
I mean, that's...
So
that's,
it's a Monday?
We know where this is going, Matt.
Is it a day ending and why? But no, Catherine, I don't know about you, but like my, whenever I see anyone, you know, David Brooks writing a column about the trouble with men, I'm like, okay, cool. I'm not going to pay attention to this cycle because it just feels like a large generalization alert about people. You looking at this conversation chatter, what does your robot individualist heart
say? I mean, I think there's, you know, there's this conversation that we've been having for a while, which is basically, do we need to affirmatively rearrange our economy in some way so that particularly less educated men won't feel so sad about their jobs, right? Like it is, I think Peter is right. Like there's something beyond just the mechanics of our policy. There is some sort of cultural thing happening. And it's not that structurally there are different opportunities available to men than women who have been thriving in this period, right? It's like the same student loans, although we've obviously talked about that, like the same support for education is available, the same job listings are available, but women are pursuing them and succeeding in them, it, you know, in a way that is disproportionate both to their historical record and to similar men. I am very wary of any argument that says we should rearrange our politics around what seems to be a cultural problem. Like just in general, that's not a good policy, both because we tend to be bad at that and because also, you know, I am old school, I guess, and believe in equality of opportunity. All the opportunities are there. And if the men are not partaking in them, that doesn't strike me as a me problem, frankly.
Although it is, I mean, there is an argument to be made that it is a problem for women because men who don't work.
It could be a women problem, but women ain't me. And I think that the same is true of the youngs, right? Like if younger people want to make trade-offs in which they, for whatever reason, don't work as much. You know, I don't know. Maybe they're right. Maybe all of us old people are the suckers and we work too much and care too much about our work. But
no, this is wrong. I mean, you actually just look at the happiness research on this and it's very clear. I was going to pivot.
You can go ahead and do my pivot for me, but I was going to pivot. I think they're wrong. And I think the happiness research shows
that
people who do things they care about and do them with intensity are generally better off in the end and that our culture is better off. All of this is just by way of saying, I don't think we should be looking for policy solutions to cultural problems. And I think that these cultural problems are real, but I also think they're almost certainly not permanent. And, you know, this will pass.
The, you know, women's labor force participation rate is also down from about 60% in 2020 to about 56%, which is below what men are at, but men is coming down. But there's something going on that, you know, I mean, Matt, the easy way to talk about this is to generationally dunk on snowflakes, millennials and Gen Z, because they are working at phenomenally lower levels than they would have the same age group 20 years ago. There is something going on. And Catherine, I think part of it is definitely cultural. You know, and I think a big part of it is that for all of our complaining about, you know, the economy and things like that, we're phenomenally richer now. And one thing that phenomenally richer societies do is that they actually subsidize people taking longer to start their adult lives. And, you know, and this is something that's been going on for at least a couple hundred years in the U.S., certainly since World War II. But there are policy, you know, determinants in some of this stuff. And, you know, what Reeves does and Eberstadt also touches on this, when you look at the completion rates of high school for men, it is going down. And like, has school become a way of punishing a lot of men who are not particularly academically inclined? I'm slow to do anything other than blame men because I've been related to a lot of shiftless, lazy men who seriously, I mean, the first time I started thinking about this was every Depression era. I mean, my parents grew up during the Depression and every story they and all my relatives and everybody I knew grew up in the Depression was, you know, the stock market crash and, you know, pop never worked again. And somehow in the same story, nobody would talk about like the mothers in those situations always worked 2, 3, 4 jobs. So it was just like men want a reason not to have to work. And we have to culturally and politically foreclose those, you know, those avenues to make it easy on them. But, you know, there is something that needs to change with compulsory schooling, like the way schools are set up. They are punishing apparently larger and larger numbers of men who just don't bother finishing high school, much less college. One of the things Reeves talks about is that the gender differential in getting college diplomas now is bigger than it was when Title IX was passed in 1972, where women got something like 13% fewer BAs than men did. It's bigger now in favor of women and growing at every level of educational attainment. We got to, you know, this is something worth talking about. And, you know, it's a mix of cultural and political issues.
Yeah, just like super, super briefly, I think two things. One, you know, if the system was previously optimized for men and now it's optimized more for women, like that's, you know, again, that's not clear to me that the solution is like revert to an optimization for men, which I think is what a lot of these arguments amount to. But the other is, I think this entire thing is just one big ultimatum game, right? Like it's this that, you know, the sort of if people perceive that they're being offered an unfair deal, they will reject the deal even to their detriment. And I think that we are having like a giant economy-wide ultimatum game in which more people believe that just like having a job is a rigged game, or maybe that the economy broadly is a rigged game. And so if you say, you know, I'm holding $10, I'll give you two and I'm going to keep eight, but we both have to agree on that deal, like more of the people who are being offered two are just saying fuck off and then no one gets anything. So I you know, the ultimatum game is like a deep, deep psychological truth that shows up over and over in studies. I don't know how to combat it, but it does seem to be getting worse.
If you're looking at economic policy incentives outside, economic incentives outside of the policy realm, the other thing we should talk about is that libertarians have, for the last 10 or 20 years, championed, I think correctly, the idea that cheap entertainment has gotten better and overall made life more interesting and more fun. But cheap entertainment and cheap and inexpensive stay-at-home pleasures, video games, streaming, giant televisions, etc., also have an economic incentive in making the cost of leaving home and going out to work, right? They make it higher. And so just like on a pure incentives level, if staying at home is a little and doing stuff that's inexpensive is a little more enjoyable, then at the margins, you would expect people to do that more often.
And in fact, that's the behavioral surveys that Nick Eberstadt gets into in his books, saying, what does this population do with its time? The ones who are never looking for work, the NILFs, not in the labor force. That is the answer.
That also stands for nobody I'd like to fuck.
Thank you.
Because they're not working. No, I mean, this is a serious thing. Reeves, by the way, delves into research that shows that the effect of video games and online pornography, male labor force participation rate approaches zero.
Yeah, I would imagine that it's more like this is what people are doing rather than necessarily cause and effect. But it's interesting to look at. Okay, enough of that now, too. Let's get to our end of podcast, what we've been consuming in the cultural sphere. Nick, do you want to lead us off?
Yeah, I went to a really interesting exhibition in New York. It's an immersive art experience called Wonderland, and it Wonderland Dreams, and it features the art of Alexa Mead, who it's this massive multi-story or two-story space in Midtown on Fifth Avenue, not far from the New York City Public Library, where you wander around different rooms that are painted in trippy kind of Alice in Wonderland themed setups. Highly recommend it. It is both imaginative in and of itself. And Alexa Mead is known for painting people and objects in a way that she turns three dimensions into two dimensions rather than the reverse. Really interesting. And I think, you know, the space is interesting in of itself, but I think it's also a harbinger of things to come. In order to get kind of people out of the house, partly because of, as Peter was talking about, your living room economy is much more interesting than it used to be. But you are going to need to be kind of coaxed out with something more immersive than simply going to a movie or even a play. And I think Wonderland Dreams in New York is, is an early instantiation of that, and one that I think people should take interest in.
I watched Amsterdam, the new movie from Oscar-nominated director David O. Russell. It has an absolutely stacked cast. Christian Bale, Margot Robbie, John David Washington, Chris Rock, Anya Taylor-Joy, Zoe Saldana, Mike Myers, Michael Shannon, Timothy Oliphant, Taylor Swift is in this movie. Rami Malek shows up for like a bunch of scenes. The cast is truly incredible. Every one of those people is capable of delivering a hyper-engaging performance and sort of bringing people in, and the movie is terrible. It is nearly unwatchable, and it's nearly unwatchable because David O. Russell decided that he wanted to make an antic comic farce in the mold of Wes Anderson and the Coen brothers about the rise of fascism in the United States. And it's this, like, kind of, sort of true story, not quite a historical episode, pre-World War II, about an attempt by some Wall Street guys to recruit a general, an ex-army general, I believe, and install him as the fascist president of the United States. And the movie just, like, it doesn't even deliver its message well. And the third act, like, is by the time you get there, you're so confused about what's going on that the movie just keeps stopping to have the characters deliver voiceover monologues, where instead of you finding out how they feel, they're just explaining what the scene was that you saw, what it meant, and what happened. And then all the villains deliver like very villainous monologues about how they're villains and about how corporations like profit either from war or from control. Either way, we just want to keep people down. And it's just, it's a trashy, stupid disaster. And it's not even that you can't make a great comic farce about the rise of fascism, because Wes Anderson did that with The Grand Budapest Hotel. And The Grand Budapest Hotel is a great movie that does all of the things that this film tries to do and really well. Amsterdam is a disaster on every level. I don't even dislike David Russell, but don't go see this. Don't waste your time. It's a bad movie that is ruined by dumb politics.
We need to have a complete and total shutdown of characters turning to the camera and explaining their inner thoughts. Until we can figure out what's going on. Catherine, what did you think of it?
Matt, are you like Donald Trump, but for the fourth wall?
Yes, kind of. I'm tired of it. Enough.
Okay.
Build the fourth wall.
It's going to be a beautiful wall. A big,
Mr.
beautiful
Trump,
fourth
tear
wall.
Down this for No, build
no,
it. Right.
Mexico
way.
Will pay
yeah.
for the fourth wall.
Okay. I read Abominations. Select Essays from a Career of Courting Self-Destruction. It is a collection of Lionel Shriver's articles and essays. It came out a couple of weeks ago, and it's delightful. If you, like me, are a Lionel Shriver fan, and you might know her from such works as The Mandibles, which I can't shut up about, you might enjoy this collection, which has... it has a lot of her stuff that she's written in the UK. She's American, but she's lived in the UK for a long time. And I don't typically somehow see stuff from The Spectator or The Guardian as much as I would like. And so I appreciate it as I, you know, sometimes I see collections of essays and I'm like, yeah, I get it. I read these already. I had not read these already. And they're very good. They're very delightful. They do not have the terrifying, resonant depth of her fiction. But absolutely worth a read. And the book is newly out. So Abominations by Lionel Shriver.
I have already mentioned mine, which is the Nicholas Ebersat update, which just came out last month of his 2016 study, Men Without Work. The update's published by Templeton Press. It's just a very brief, brisk read with lots of charts. Do it in a morning, afternoon type of thing. And it just illustrates basically one big point, which is the half century defection of dudes from the labor force. And in a style that I'm increasingly in favor of as I get older and having a narrower belief in my own sense of prognostications or beliefs or whatever, that it just is showing, it's illustrating a weird issue / problem, if you think it's a problem, and I think it probably is, in a way to say, hey, look, this is kind of big, and it's a little bit of an elephant in the room when we talk about employment economy and a bunch of other stuff, or the diversion between the creation of wealth, as Nick was talking about before, and the lack of usual concurrent growth of economic productivity. That's kind of a new thing. And so what that all means, it's people looking for solutions won't necessarily find them. And there's an afterword by a couple of dissenting economists, Henry Olson and I think Jared Bernstein, who kind of given us some trouble. So that's kind of fun, too. But just like it opens your eyes about an issue you might not have paid attention to before. And it's pretty interesting. So go check it out. Nicholas Eberstadt, a member of that work. I wrote up a little bit about that on Friday. And a fun fact about Eberstadt, his grandfathers, one was Ogden Nash, and the other one was the co-founder of the CIA. So that's exciting. Okay, that's all the weird East Coast family lore. And his sister was a Warhol girl, factory girl. That's all the weird East Coast creepiness.
I thought you were going to give us a little Ogden Nash kind of pre-Rich Hall Sniglet verse, Matt Welch.
You know, if you have some Ogden on the tip of your tongue, Nick, now would be the time to deliver.
He did a couple of really terrible baseball poems, didn't he?
Oh, they're all terrible.
Is there any other kind of poem besides a terrible baseball poem?
No, not really. Yeah.
I think baseball is poetry all on its own.
Thanks, George Will.
It is like a ballet, but not a...
No, no. The ballet is like The Mandalorian.
With fat people in tight suits complaining about stuff all the time and standing around
scratching their privates. Okay. Yeah. Oh. Okay. If you enjoyed this podcast,
go see your doctor immediately.
Go see a doctor. Go to reason.com/podcast. See all of our offerings there. If you like what we do as an organization, consider donating tax-deductible Bitcoin to reason.com/donate. And we'll see you next week. Happy Indigenous Italians Day, and goodbye.